91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour we begin with a discussion about how South Florida suburbs and municipalities can best revitalize their environs. Then, resident chef Linda Gastenheimer tells about new area venues for Middle Eastern cuisine. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. How is it that some cities make dramatic turnarounds while others continue to languish? We'll visit with two experts who've worked in South Florida communities. And chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gastenheimer tells about a healthy take on Middle Eastern food with new restaurant openings in our area. So stay with us. Topical Currents after NPR and regional news. And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman on our Thursday edition. Sort of our weekend begins now, Bonnie.
It's a long weekend, too.
Yes, it is. We'll be returning on Tuesday to Topical Currents. I hope you have a great holiday weekend.
And you and all of you.
Hope our weather holds up, too. It's not too hot. Well, today's program begins with a nuts and bolts look at how South Florida communities can best approach revitalization, early 21st century style. Why do some areas seem to deteriorate while others make dramatic turnarounds?
We'll talk to seasoned experts about it. Both are former redevelopment agency directors in South Florida and lead a firm called Redevelopment Management Associates, or RMA. It's based in Pompano Beach.
First, it's Kim Briesmeister, formerly the Redevelopment Agency Director in West Palm Beach, Florida, and co-founder of RMA. Welcome to you, Kim. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having us.
And also with us is the company co-founder, Christopher Brown. He's a past Community Redevelopment Agency Director in Delray Beach. Welcome to you, Christopher.
Well, thank you for having us.
Together, they've written the book Reinventing Your City, 8 Steps to Turn Your City Around. So I thought we'd begin with each of your backgrounds and how you founded RMI. Kim, we'll start with you.
Okay, great. My background actually began abroad. I was in Curaçao in the Netherlands Antilles, and that island was going through a redevelopment process downtown, and they were looking for somebody to help them work through that those steps. And it was quite an experience because there was 30 different nationalities and cultures. The buildings were a few hundred years old. The street grids, obviously, were, you know, European style. They were already finite. So redevelopment options were very limited, and it wasn't like in some of our communities in the States where you can kind of build from the ground up. But it was a phenomenal introduction to the components that are important from the property owners, the business owners, the community at large, to engage them in that whole redevelopment process. I eventually moved back to the United States and went to work for the Hollywood Community Redevelopment Agency, later on the City of Fort Lauderdale, CRA, and then West Palm Beach. And then in 2009, I had already had my own company. But Chris and I decided when the City of Pompano Beach was putting out a bid to look for a management firm to help them go through the redevelopment process, we decided to combine our firms and bid on that job. And we were selected, and the company and the concept of having a firm help city manage redevelopment has just really taken off. It's been quite successful.
It seems so. And you, Christopher?
Well, I come out of the real estate industry. I graduated from University of Pennsylvania grad school, went right into redevelopment in Houston, Texas, my hometown, and then migrated to Florida, having worked for another public company, a fairly large one from Canada. And then I took some time off from the real estate industry when a recession occurred. And I decided to switch from suburban development to urban development because I thought that was a trend that was about ready to happen, and that, That was in the early 90s. So I took a job as executive director of the CRA for Delray. And at the time in 1991, Delray was not healthy. It had 1 million square feet on its ground floor and 500,000 was vacant. So I had a daunting task of getting 500,000 square feet leased. And the town was built. So that's my background. And then Kim indicated that we joined forces in 2009. It's been a good partnership.
Well, Christopher Brown, let's
different backgrounds.
Let's go back to downtown Delray. It was termed Death Valley after dark. What did you do specifically to make the big turnaround there? You talked about more of a 500,000 square feet of space was empty.
Well, the first thing you have to do is you have to have a vision. And when I got to Delray, I saw something going on. It was a little mustard seed that was planted in Delray, and it was the rehabilitation of the 6th school, and they were going to make it into a cultural center.
Would you repeat that last sentence, Chris? We just lost you. It just cut out for a second.
I'm sorry. When I got to Delray in 1991, I looked at, in the first week, I looked at a project that was being announced, and it was the rehabilitation of an abandoned school, a K-12 1926 school, historic school, into a cultural center. And I said, all right, they're going to go for the arts. So I, in my own mind and in our agency, I said, we're going to brand this city Arts and Entertainment. So that was the brand I was reaching for, because when you're in real estate, any project you build, you must brand the project. And so for downtowns, there's no difference. So my first order of business was to promote the arts and promote entertainment. And entertainment meant, with my kind of background, was to attract new businesses, and that was restaurants. I probably recruited 24 restaurants in Delray, and you can see them today on the street. I tried to recruit others, but they weren't as successful, and particularly national retailers. No national retailer in 1991 wanted to go to Delray Beach. Now they're dying to go in. And, of course, that's almost that's 25 years later. But so the first step is to have a vision, and you must brand the vision. And I had a very fortunate situation in Delray where there was leadership, and the leadership came from the mayor, Tom Lynch, who was at the time a newly elected mayor. He was an insurance executive, and he was all business, and he was a big promoter and a big decision maker, and he didn't quiver when he got the phone calls an hour before a city commission meeting to kill something that we were proposing. He stayed the course. So he was a big part of it.
You know, many of our listeners, I'm sure, I enjoyed Delray myself, and I'm sure many of our listeners know what a great destination it is. But I was thinking how reinventing a city or redeveloping a city can be such a great thing. But in so many cases, many residents are pushed out and have few options as the gentrification moves in. So in what ways do you address that all too common quandary?
Kim?
Well, it really depends on the area. I think every city is quite different. Some areas start off, and you can recognize them, with a lot of vacant properties, and then there's, you know, a patchwork of single-family homes that remain. And that's a very difficult situation, because the few single-family homes that are there, if it's in an urban environment, that growth is simply going to change the use, and you're going to go from the old style street grid to more of an urban environment. It is likely that those single family houses or even duplexes will be bought up, and they will change. That's not something, in an urban area, that is going to happen any differently just by the nature of urban growth. That said, there's a lot of examples where the existing property owners or business owners or families can remain, and urban environments can grow up around them. Delray is probably one of a good example, and that a lot of that growth occurred on a main street in the urban core, and then as the growth continued, it worked its way back into the neighborhoods, but not at the total displacement of the area around it. Sistrunk Boulevard in Fort Lauderdale is another one, mm-hmm. where the main street is getting revitalized, but all of those single-family neighborhoods, some of those houses might come down and they might go back up as townhouses or a little bit more dense product, but it wasn't a wholesale gentrification or wipe an area out. I actually think that concept is more, it's perceived to happen more often than it actually does. It really is a slow process, and it isn't as if, you know, within a 1, 2, or 3 year period, all of a sudden whole areas are changed. It usually doesn't quite work that way.
It seems that one of the premises expressed in your book is to not really worry that much about density and traffic, that somehow that'll kind of take care of itself, and that the traffic is actually generated by outsiders. Is that correct?
This is Chris Brown, and in the case of Delray, we're going to use that as one of our examples today.
Right.
The key was to try to get housing program, get new housing, new urban housing downtown that not only provided housing for newcomers, but it also provided housing for those that wanted to move out of their larger houses and into smaller apartments. So gentrification was never really a big issue in Delray because we did both affordable housing and new urban housing. But the urban housing, you have to remember, those people don't create traffic because they may drive out of the garage or the parking lot in the morning and they may come back in the evening. But when they go out to dinner or they go to a cultural affair, they walk. Delray is a walkable city, and that's what everybody does. And that's what you have to do when you reinvent your city. Portland is another fine example. Everybody walks in Portland or takes the transit.
We're speaking with Kim Breesmeister and Christopher Brown. They're the founders and principals of Redevelopment Management Associates, RMA. And they've also authored Reinventing Your City, 8 Steps to Turn Your City Around. On today's Topical Currents, a short break, and we'll be back with them.
And we're back with Christopher Brown and Kim Breesmeister. We're talking about their book, Reinventing Your City, 8 Steps to Turn Your City Around. And of course, they both have great hands-on experience here in South Florida in revitalizing many areas. Something we did touch on, Chris, Christopher, that you didn't really talk about was the traffic, and that your philosophy seems to be that the traffic will kind of take care of itself because it's mostly outsiders. Citizens seem to find that the case?
Well, I think that traffic can be solved by two basic, very important things. One is to build housing downtown so people walk, and also you have to have traffic management, which means you have to have parking management. And so one of the things that happens when you don't have parking management, people, particularly people from the outside, are always trying to get in front of the place they're trying to go to, a restaurant or whatever, and they circle around and circle around. And what you want to do is prevent that. So you have to have a parking management system that has a hierarchy of fees and availability. You always want to charge at the most desirable location. This is meter fees. And the least fee on the less desirable. So you have a choice, and there's always a parking available. This was proven in Pasadena, California, where the fees were on Main Street were 3 or 4 times that, 2 or 3 blocks away, and there was always parking available, as long as you're willing to pay for it.
And I can add in just a recent topic. As of the other night, there was a commission meeting in Pompano because we're helping the city go through a process to bring more residential units for development in the east side of town. And that was one of the main questions, is what are we going to do with all this additional traffic? And it's a real valid question.
Right.
It's a concern, and what you want to try to do is at this stage that we're at, which is the planning stage, before the units are available, before the developers even have built the projects, that's why I think that's this city's doing it correctly. You want to think through how and where that traffic's going to flow and try to accommodate it. And there really are quite a few mechanisms that you can use, everything from, you know, the lights, how they're timed, how traffic flows, where you intentionally divert traffic off to, or where you intentionally don't let it divert to into neighborhoods, et cetera. So I think Pompano Beach is doing a very good job at stepping through that process, but working on the traffic management plan before the buildings are built.
You didn't get any lessons from Miami Beach, I suppose.
Or Miami.
Not going to touch that one.
Okay. We're just thinking, like, we're here on 15th Street off Northeast 2nd Avenue and Biscayne Boulevard, and what is already a heavily trafficked area, for example, they're developing what I guess they call the Biscayne Corridor with humongous high-rises that are going up
in
the
20s. We still have many cranes here.
Yes, the bird. So when you take over a project, because it seems like maybe it's when all these different people get in the mix that maybe these things, the infrastructure, the traffic, those things are not planned in advance. Is that something your firm does differently?
Well, we are pretty proactive. Again, the example I just gave you was us suggesting that the city proactively go out and pick the number of units it wants to develop in an area, plan out the traffic and the transportation and the transit options, do the design guidelines so that you know how tall you want the buildings and where you want them to be, and then you all go down that path for the next 15, 20 years together. That is definitely, I think, a strategy that Chris and I try to encourage cities to do. Miami is, you know, just a whole different world in how over the decades it's developed and where it finds itself today. And it's right in that transition stage of really having to get more of a transit connection and mobility system in place. But quite frankly, that does take time, and you need the density to be able to support it. So I actually think over time Miami has the opportunity to improve the mobility and the systems that are there. They just have to go through that that planning process.
Is it that you're really kind of trying to make parking not terrible, but a little more difficult so that people won't be able to zoom up right in front of the restaurant there and park, I guess, unless they're valeting, but they do have to park a distance away and have to walk and therefore walk by more businesses and have more of an experience like that rather than zipping into your restaurant and or your store and then zipping out?
I think you definitely want to put your parking off of the main street. You do want to make them walk probably not more than two and a half blocks if possible. I'm going to give you one example of a city that has a very, very strict urban policy. It happens to be in Spain. It's Madrid. Madrid had such gridlock on their streets that the only solution they had was to close the street. But they solved the problem of traffic by closing the street, but they built, in the perimeter, they built garages so people would go to the perimeter of the downtown, park in the garage, and then walk to their destination. Now, they have mass transit in Madrid, but people love to walk in Spain. And that's what we have to become in this society, less of a car society and more of a walking society.
Of course, many of the population, though, here in South Florida are elderly, and also 10 or 11 months of really intense heat that maybe people don't want to walk, you know, three blocks to get to a restaurant.
Well, right? I think walking is very good for the elderly. You're talking to one of them on the phone. So. I walk all the time.
Well, and if you're you're in shape enough to be able to do that, that you're correct. Many aren't.
You say that a key lesson in urban redevelopment is about changing the status quo, and you go on further to say the person who's benefiting from the status quo will not be happy when change is proposed, and they may be in a position to significantly influence or even kill the project. So how do cities deal with that, or communities?
That's a very prevalent situation, because change is scary to a lot of people.
Right.
A lot of people just plain don't want it. They legitimately know what the future is, and they say, I just don't want that to happen. There's two things that we try to do, and we think it's important. Cities really do need to engage the citizens, but they have to remember there's two citizen groups. There's the ones that are there today, and then obviously, even without growth, citizens change. Economies evolve. new people come in, you know, folks get older, and then different folks might come in afterwards and buy those same or rent those same properties. So cities need to hear from the folks that are at the table today, but they also need to anticipate, you know, what folks that might move in later or new businesses that might move in later, what their wants and needs are as well. So the first is the active engagement. The second one, and we have had that situation a couple times where folks just plain dug their heels in and said, I don't want this, and I don't want, in this one case, I'll use Pompano again because it's easy, they didn't want parking on Pompano Beach Boulevard. There were condominiums, and they didn't want cars parking at the beach in front of them. And our point was, but you need to allow others to come down here and park at this beach, and they're going to need to get to the restaurants. We have to allow that parking to come. And eventually we got there. It started off with a lot of, you know, scared people, and they had concerns. And if you go down there now and you were to pull those condominium owners, now that there's the parking, it's all in there, everybody's using the beach, they're some of the happiest condominium owners because they have this beautiful new revitalized beachfront in front of them. But it's not something that you can avoid, and it's just a process that you have to go through.
It's sort of an interesting, Kim brought up the issue that you plan for the future residents. We built, our firm managed a project in Pompano, $15 million beach renovation, including that parking that was not there before. And we noticed over the last 5 years even that the residents that live in the condos have changed. They've gotten younger, and they are excited about the beautiful beach they live on, and they're not so reticent to change anymore. And so those were some of the people we were planning for that weren't there in the beginning.
There seems to be such a fine line between redevelopment of a blighted area for the benefit of many and overdevelopment of that area because of greed. So how do you do the former and avoid the latter?
I think those are two, again, really distinct questions. The word greed is easily managed because if cities are proactive and if they plan, and if they go through a process with the community to define a vision, like Chris started the conversation with,
right.
And everybody says, yes, this is the kind of development pattern and footprint we want. This is how we want our development to look and how high and how dense. It limits the greed because the story is already written and the rules are made. What sometimes developers like is to come in and say, well, I want to change that. I have to go higher. I need to do this.
And they buy airspace or whatever it's called, and they go
right.
Several stories higher than everything else in the area.
Yeah, and the cities, again, that haven't really solidified the vision and are in lockstep of how they view the community evolving, those are the ones that will have that constant battle, and it'll be viewed as the greedy developers coming in, and which sometimes they are, versus an anti-development sentiment, which is only generated because you have this ping-pong effect that happens, and it's really not healthy. So what we try to do, again, is get cities to figure it out up front as best they can, get the residents involved, have future business owners and developers that are interested in coming in there, bring them to the table right when you're in that planning stage. And have those discussions up front. And it's not often done. It's a very, very difficult thing to do, but it's the most effective way of managing that that unhealthy growth pattern.
You know, Kim and Christopher, that's the key, I believe, really, to avoid that. And you're right. And it is involving the community. I think that's really so key to making things happen and having the vision. So we thank you for being with us. Kim Briesmeister and Christopher Brown are the founders and principals of Redevelopment Management Associates. They're experts in the field of redevelopment. They have combined 50 years of experience that guide municipal leaders nationwide on their quest to reinvent their own cities. They've written Reinventing Your City, 8 Steps to Turn Your City Around. We thank both of you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Food and Dining, up next. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. A holiday weekend is upon us. Perhaps it's a good time to try some new restaurant
fare. It's going to be a hot one, too, you can tell.
Well, let's hope that's all it is. With our population of many, many ethnicities here in South Florida, the possibilities are vast. Of course, resident chef author and syndicated columnist Linda Gassenheimer has ideas on the subject, and also a topical currents guest who definitely has thoughts on that subject. Welcome, Linda.
Nice to see you, Bonnie and Joe. Great to be here.
Welcome back.
Back from the Fancy Food Show in New York City, and we're going to have lots of food coming on here.
And we'll have a program about it.
Absolutely.
I'm sure, too.
All the trends, what's happening, etc. But meanwhile, here's a question. Can we have fast food? Can it be healthy? Can it be tasty? And can it be affordable?
Yes.
Yes, according to our chef. And our guest today, he's Danny Gannam. He's the executive chef, and he's the co-owner of Zouk Mediterranean Kitchen. It's near Mary Brickell Village. So let's welcome Danny Gannam.
Thank you. It's so awesome to be here.
Go. We love you. You brought a lot of food here.
It's so colorful, too, this plate. My God.
Beautiful. And the studio really smells good. Okay, so we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Are you looking for fast food options? Or what are your pet peeves or likes and some ideas you'd like to share with our guest? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
I just want to add in, fast food doesn't have to taste like fast food, because it doesn't.
No, you've been eating away here, I see. Bonnie, do we have the internet today?
We do. It's radio@WLRN.org.
And our favorite wine guy is not with us today.
Oh.
He's on vacation, and it's his anniversary, so happy anniversary to Fred Tesker.
Happy anniversary, Fred.
Yeah. And he's going to join us. He'll be back next week, but he did send some wine suggestions for Mediterranean foods, and we'll talk about that later. But meanwhile, Danny Gannam, congratulations on this new restaurant, Zouk Mediterranean Kitchen. Zouk, Z-U-U-K, that's kind of an unusual name. What does it mean?
So we were playing around with Sam, Roger, and I. We were playing about what we can make it a little bit catchy, and then we thought about market, you know. Then us, we want to be something that's fresh, something that, you know, go to the market and check it out. So we thought about that word and just made up our own word. And
just a made up word.
Yeah.
Okay. It's almost like a souk,
yeah,
like in the Middle
exactly.
East.
Yeah.
Souk, right. Okay, except it's zouk.
Mm-hmm.
Fine. Okay, well, I was there, and I was very impressed with your concept about your quality and price. Explain the concept, because it's unusual.
So pretty much you're a fast casual Mediterranean restaurant that we serve pita rolls, bowls, and salads. And then the guests pretty much have the control. They have the creative power to make it their own. So they come in, they check out their bases, which we have basmati turmeric with turmeric rice. And also we have herb bulgur, which is cracked wheat.
So let me explain that. You can have either a bowl or it could be a wrap.
Mm-hmm.
Or a salad.
Or a salad.
Yep.
Or in a salad thing. And what you do is you go down the line and you've got, what?
Your dips, your proteins.
Well, first
and your
you have your salad thing, so you can pick out lots of different things.
Oh, yeah.
For your salad.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go to the next section and it's all there for your display for you to see. And you can pick out a protein, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go, you have all these different dips. Or spreads, or whatever you want to call them. Yes.
Yes, we have our classic hummus. We have our red pepper hummus. Some smoky baba ganoush, and some calamari olive dip, and some mint tzatziki, and
just the
feta.
Red pepper hummus.
That one is a spicy sauce. That's the harissa. So if you like spicy, go for it.
and Joe, after you've got picked out all of this, and it goes into your sandwich, salad, or your bowl, whichever you want. Then you have a pick of sauces,
mm-hmm.
and that's what you were holding up, is the different sauces.
Yes.
We left, Joe's opening them now, because I left the ones that were really hot spicy for him to open.
I'm trying it carefully. Oh, that's very nice. It's not so hot.
Which one are you taking?
The hot one.
Yes, it is hot.
It just takes a while to kick in.
We did warn you.
This light green one.
That one has some cilantro and also tahini. So tahini is a...
Oh, that's very good, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right, and so, but what I found was fascinating is that everything's freshly made. I mean, you can see people, you're not getting chicken that's coming out of a package or something. Mm-hmm. It's all chicken that's roasted, or how do you?
So pretty much, you know, what we get all natural chicken. So it's no hormones, it's antibiotic free, and we marinate it. Everything is done in house. Everything. And the guys, they cook it fresh for you in front of you, and that you can see when the guys, you know, they're cooking the lamb, they're cooking the chicken. Also, we slow roast the beef, so you know that you see it when the guys are cooking it, and they bake the falafels too.
So you can, and it's baked, not fried, the falafels.
Oh, yes.
So you can, and all that's done for you in minutes, really.
Mm-hmm.
But what I thought was amazing is that everything on the menu is $8.85.
Exactly.
Of the whole meal, whether it's lunch, breakfast, whatever you've chosen, or that, there's just one price.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you do that? How do you have all that fresh food at such a good price?
So pretty much we're all about.
And then people might say, why is that a good price? Well, this is a whole dinner. For
yeah.
That, actually, it's everything.
Mm-hmm. So pretty much, you know, we're all about thoughtfully sourced ingredients. And by thoughtfully sourced, you know, it means that we want to have something that's, you know, good for you, that has, no hormones, is all about antibiotic free. We have some ingredients that might be organic, like our chickpeas. But our main thing is about being thoughtfully sourced. It's about, you know, having partners as our purveyors. Those guys, you know,
your purveyors,
yes.
the vendors, the people you buy from,
yeah.
Right?
Those guys, they know that where we want to be, what we want to do, and we've been working with them. Well, I've been working with them, and also Sam, my partner, I've been working
Sam
with them.
Sam Gorenstein, uh-huh. Who's also owns My Ceviche.
Yeah.
Okay, so
I just want to add, there are extras you can add on.
Mm-hmm.
Right, go ahead. Yeah.
The base price is uh-huh.
$8.85 for a pita roll.
Okay, but then you have many, many, many extras and chips and rice and seasonal vegetables, soup.
Yeah,
those
exactly.
Things.
So those are like little side items,
right.
That you know you can get just to enhance your meal. But for like this bowl that you can see over here, you know that's pretty much $8.85.
Right,
and that's a huge.
It's
bowl.
Huge.
Let's talk about this because you've been eating it away, and we're talking about. We didn't say what's here. So tell us, there's a chicken bowl here. Now, what's in that chicken bowl?
So that chicken bowl, so as you can see, you can always, you know, choose your base, which that one has lettuce. That one has our power
so
greens.
So first you choose the base, and
exactly.
you put lettuce on it, and then?
Then you can, then you choose your dips, and which that one, I believe, has red pepper hummus, olive dip.
Right, mm-hmm.
And yogurt dip, which
wow.
Is a mint tzatziki.
Wow, and then it's got some corn, and it's got some olives. There's so much on here.
So you get to choose up. We recommend up to five toppings. So our toppings, you know, everything is nice and fresh. And then the pickled ones, like the pickled cabbage, we make them in house. Same thing as the pickled jalapenos. Everything is made in house. And then you know, it's the person that creates their own. Some people might just want chicken and rice. And some people, they just want to go all the way and then, you know, put a bunch of toppings in and
it's
go for it.
It's got a blast of nice fresh mint.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, cilantro.
And so each bowl is very colorful. And by the way, I've put photos up on the whips on my Facebook page. You can go to the Facebook page and look at them and see the photos. Also on Instagram. so you can see what it looks like. And there's a very interesting backstory here, I think, anyway, because Danny Gannon, your background is Arab from your grandmother.
Yeah.
And your partner, Sam Gorenstein, has a Jewish background. And I thought, well, you're great friends. You've been working together for years.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great image and role model for the rest of the world, I think. But do you find the types of foods from your different backgrounds, are they similar or are they different?
They're very similar, you know. Sam also, you know, he's Colombian. My mother's Panamanian. So, you know,
we've got a huge background.
A huge background, yes. But for the Mediterranean side, for the Middle Eastern side, we grew up with that food. And we wanted to make sure that we can bring something that's something that, you know, comes from the heart to the people. You know, Sam and I, we've come from the fine dining background. And we have known the great ingredients, the quality ingredients, you know, that are expensive. And we were like, you know what, how can we get those ingredients and that comes from the heart and show it to people and just have something that's good for them, healthy for them, and an approachable price with the same quality of ingredients. And that's been our mission.
And then you have a very unusual dessert because your dessert has tahini in it. So tell us about that dessert.
Well, yeah, so we have the two desserts. We have the baklava.
Which we have here, by the way. Which is really
I'm going to try the baklava.
Tell everybody what's in it, because it's really the authentic baklava.
Yeah.
tell us what's in it.
So our baklava has some almonds, walnuts, also some honey, some rose water. So, you know, it's something that, you know, comes, same thing. We grew up with it, and it is. And in the beginning, we were like, oh, you know what, we want to put the baklava, but everybody was asking for something like that. And plus with our tahini froyo.
Tell us what the tahini froyo is.
So our tahini froyo is it's a Greek yogurt, like a frozen yogurt with some tahini, honey, and also we've been experimenting with some new flavors, and so it's pretty cool things that you're going to see.
You're going to have a chocolate...
Yes.
Froyo with tahini. But isn't it unusual to put tahini? Yeah. Tell us what's in tahini.
So tahini is pretty much is like the peanut butter, but of sesame. So sesame seeds that get stone ground, and then it gets all together with the fat of the sesame, and it's full of protein. So it's good. Actually, it's very good for you, like peanut butter. You know, people say, like, peanut butter, they just add the sugar.
So you blend it with sesame oil?
Well, no, it's already made out. It's,
okay. Mm-hmm.
This oil comes out of the seeds as they're blending it. That's
yeah. Back to this baklava. Don't tell me you make your own rose water on it.
No. We don't make the rose water.
That would be, but it gives a wonderful, wonderful flavor. You know, I just came back from a conference. I was at an international conference in Tel Aviv. And again, I was very impressed by the Middle Eastern food, very fresh vegetables. Really wonderful. But I did take a cooking class. And I took a cooking class from in a Druze home. That's Druze. Now, the Druze are a sect that centuries and centuries ago, they broke away from Islam. And they have their own kind of religion. But their food was wonderful. But one thing, along with your tahini, is that we made a meatloaf. And the meatloaf was like 2 inches thick. Very, very thin meatloaf. And then when it came out of the oven, cooked very quickly, they put a tahini sauce over it, and that melted into it. So how do they make the tahini sauce?
So pretty much, you know, sometimes, you know, some people, they just mix it with a little bit of liquid, like water and some olive oil and some or lemon juice, and they make it nice and thin, and it's just great with those, with the meats.
But it was really an unusual way to serve something and put a tahini sauce in it. Well, we're going to take a break now. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with Chef Danny Ganim about Zouk Mediterranean Kitchen. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. Back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we've been talking with Danny Ganim. He's the executive chef, and he's the co-owner of Zouk Mediterranean Kitchen, and that's near Mary Brickell Village in Miami. And he's been telling us about how he and his co-owner, Sam Gorenstein, created a fast food, healthy, affordable restaurant, and delicious, because we've been eating all this food here, and it's really, really tasty, because it's freshly made, and yes. You know, you couldn't ask for anything more. Well, now it's dinner in minutes time, and we do have a big weekend coming up. In case you hadn't realized, it's 4th of July. So my dinner in minutes is a sparkling burger. It's a Texas turkey burger with a corn and black bean salad. And these burgers get their bang from jalapeno peppers. And I mix some chopped jalapeno peppers with mayonnaise. Joe, you can make this with beef, but I did use ground turkey, but it could be with beef. I know that's what you would ask.
Are the turkeys bigger in Texas?
I didn't ask.
Okay.
I'm sure that's true. So I mixed the turkey, ground turkey, with barbecue sauce. And so it gives you a nice barbecue flavor, but you don't have to stand around at the grill in this hot weekend. You just add some sauce, form it to burgers, and sauté them in the pan. And while they cook, you mix the chopped jalapeno peppers with the mayonnaise. When the burgers are done, you put them on the bottom half of a burger bun. You put some tomato and lettuce on top. And then I put on the top of the bun, the bun top, actually. I just put the mayonnaise and put it all together. And it's really delicious. And for the salad, it's canned black beans that you drain and rinse. And some frozen corn kernels are defrosted. And just toss them with a little salad dressing. Very colorful, very easy, and be perfect for this 4th of July. The complete recipe and a photo, it can be found on my website. That's dinnerinminutes.com. And also you can see at Facebook, you can see Danny Ganim and his wonderful salads and his bowls. But follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. So as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, wine columnist Fred Tasker is on vacation, and he's going to return next week. But he did send me some wine suggestions to go with Middle Eastern food. So he says, according to Fred, if you want wines that go well with with Mediterranean food, it's a safe bet to choose, guess what?
Champagne.
Bubblies.
Mediterranean wines. The champagne's coming in a minute, though.
Okay.
And he says they go well together. They've been coexisting for thousands of years. Now, these wines are from all that he's talked about. They're from all over the Mediterranean Sea. And so that includes, you know, coastal areas of France and Italy and Sicily and Greece and Cyprus and Israel, Lebanon and parts of Africa. And this is where wine on a commercial scale was born. And he's talking about the history. The Phoenicians, the Greeks, and the Romans, they influenced by the climate. They made wonderful wines there. So, and he says they're not light, crisp Pinot Grigios or Rieslings. They're not sturdy tannic wines of Bordeaux and Burgundy. They're soft, fruity red wines. And so he has some wines from the Mediterranean area, from three different Mediterranean regions. First of all, he has a wine called Yarden Winery's Kosher Chardonnay. It's from Israel's Golan Heights. It's rich and full-bodied and ripe pear and mineral-flavored foods. And he says, Danny, that you should have that with hummus or stuffed eggplant. What do you think?
Yeah.
Yes? It's good?
That
okay.
Sounds good.
It's $19 a bottle. And then there's another wine, a Côte de Rhône, and it's Gigal, and it's spelled G-U-I-G-A-L, and it's a rosé from France. And he thinks that would go good with, it's drier than most American rosés, he said. Good with French coq au vin.
Yes. Nice.
Okay. And then Torres Winery, Sangre de Toro. It's a red wine from Spain. And that would go very nice with a Spanish paella. So he's taking the Mediterranean, it's going everywhere. We have a caller on line two. Hi, Amy, you're on the air. Hello, Amy?
Yeah?
You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Amy. Go ahead. Do you have a question or a comment for us?
Question, comment. I recently was in Bethesda, Maryland, and I went to a fast food restaurant called Cava Grill, which has a very similar feel to what the chefs were describing.
Right. Uh-huh.
So I was just asking if he had been inspired by this place. Was it different to Cava Grill to some extent?
Right.
And I just had been dreaming about this day when somebody would come with this idea to South Florida.
I'm not sure he knows what the Cava Grill is. Do you?
Well, I've known about the many fast casual restaurants across the United States. But, you know, for us, you know, my ceviche started here in Miami 4 years ago. And our background from the Mediterranean restaurant, you know, came with just because of Sam and I's background here, and you know, we wanted to do something fresh. And at the end of the day, you know, there's plenty of ideas that they cross each other from many other chefs. But you know, I see that Cava's they have some good food over there in Washington D.C.
Right. So Amy, you know, as I mentioned earlier in the program, I just came back from New York. And I went to a fast food restaurant there, and I was impressed to see that it was a very similar kind of thing. And perhaps, Amy, this is what's happening now, is that you go down the line and you can pick something from A and something from B and something from C, and it's all one price, and you fill your bowl or whatever with it. But what I was impressed with Danny is that he's kept the price down by making really fresh food in-house as you're ordering. So does that answer your question, Amy?
Absolutely. And I'm also from Panama, and I'm very familiar with the Sephardic food. And so I'm just very impressed. So thank you for having me on the air.
Thank you for your call. Thank you. So let's go. We haven't talked yet about drinks. And there was one that's becoming, that's very refreshing. It's becoming well-known, popular. When I first had it, I wasn't so impressed with it. I have to be honest with you. It's called kombucha. Mm-hmm. K-O-M-B-U-C-H-A. It's a fermented tea, and it's got yeast in it. It tastes kind of like vinegar and carbonated apple cider.
Oh, it sounds really appetizing, Linda.
Tell us more about it, because this was one that I had at Zook that was actually... I went for seconds, okay?
Mm. Well, so kombucha is pretty much, you know, a fermented tea that is very good for you. The people that they have tried kombucha and they're in it, they just love it. And right now our kombucha, so we're getting it from a local purveyor. He makes it in here in Miami. It's something that, you know, he plays around with the flavors, with the fruits. So right now he has like some dragon fruit with blueberries, also some passion fruit kombucha, and you know it's great for you. Good for your
digestion,
for your body, for your digestion.
Yes, so. It was very. And then you had something else. You had mango, and you had, what was the flavor in the mango juice?
So we have also craft juices, and our craft juices we make them in house. So those craft juices we change seasonally, and we have right now our mango coriander, and also we have our strawberry mint lemonade, and also we have a coconut green tea.
Well, so I found that was really interesting because I think a lot of people are doing this now. You're finding them in sorbets and all that. We're getting sweets with savory herbs. Mm-hmm. And it makes it a very, very interesting food, a drink. And, well, we could go on with more and more, but it's really been a tasty week. Joe's just busy eating away there.
The baklava, I think.
Yeah, well, that's gone.
Stole his heart.
Mm-hmm. That went before the savory food.
That's why I've been so quiet. Give me some baklava. There's your answer, Johnny.
All right. Thank you, Chef Danny Ganim, for joining us and for the wonderful food.
Thank you.
Zook Mediterranean Kitchen is located at 1250 South Miami Avenue. It's near Mary Brickell Village. Fred Tasker is going to be back with us next week with more wine suggestions. Joe and Bonnie, you ate well today.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, we did, that baklava.
Ooh. Right. Well, next week we're going to be talking with Richard Campbell from Fairchild Tropical Garden.
I wonder if it's that time again.
Well, it's mango time.
Right. It's one of our favorites. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
I still can't figure out how to cut one of those.
He'll tell us again.
Again. And that wraps up today's program. Bonnie, you ate very well today.
Well, thank you. And you're smiling, Joe.
Yes, I am.
Oh, did I take Linda's line?
And we have a long weekend ahead of us.
We do. What are you going to do?
I'm not sure. Maybe we should go to the beach and have a barbecue, you and I and a few friends.
Weather permitting.
I think you should take my dinner in minutes and barbecue inside with my turkey things that are sautéed.
There is something to say about air conditioning on the 4th of July. Our lead producer on Topical Currents is Richard Ives. Technical supervision from Jason Zabka, and Polly Landis is associate producer. Might want to spend some time on the WLRN.org website for more information about our public broadcast services, including Channel 17. Also, free audio downloads of Topical Currents, again, at WLRN.org. You can link it along to a friend or listen again.
And we have our Facebook page.
Yes, we do.
WLRN's Facebook, topicalcurrents.com/ Topical. I mean, what am I saying?
Whatever it is.
Facebook.com.
Just put in Topical Currents
and maybe
drop us a like. Tomorrow at 1, it's Here and Now, and we'll be off for the Independence Day holiday, Bonnie and I. So listen for the Capital Step special at 1 o'clock on Monday. We'll return Tuesday the 5th with a program centering on the 100th anniversary of the U.S. National Park Service. South Florida is blessed with several of them within a drive from us.
Also, the Big Cypress National Preserve is nearby. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Linda Gassenheimer, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now next from NPR News.
Joe,
addiction doesn't